If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
By his own account, State Representative Travis Fitzwater was underestimated in the competitive Republican primary for the 10th Senatorial District. But the Callaway County Republican defied expectations and is all but assured to be in the Missouri Senate after 2023. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Fitzwater explains why he won that race and talks about the issues he wants to champion in the General Assembly's upper chamber. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me in studio today, she is St. Louis Public Radio State House and politics reporter.
Sarah Kellogg, good to be here in person still.
Good to see you in person still. And joining us via Zoom, he is effectively the senator-elect for the 10th District, barring a libertarian revolution.
State Representative Travis Fitzwater.
Representative, thank you so much for joining us today. But I just want to kind of jump into this 10th District Republican primary, because there were a lot of state Senate primaries that were interesting. And over the next few weeks, I think we're going to bring on some of the Republican and Democratic winners of these. But this one, I think, like, took the cake as far as, like, complexity and, like, suspensefulness. What do you think it took for you to win this primary that included a self-funding candidate who has been on the ballot many times, a former state representative, and a current state representative, along with two other candidates?
Well, thank you all for having me on. It's always a joy to talk with you all. You guys do a great job. I think it's fun to talk about because it's still kind of surreal. You know, 3 days ago, us winning that massive primary, having been outspent close to 2-1, 3-1, something like that, was just an incredible honor. And I think there's a lot of detail to it, but I think a lot of things worked in our favor, and a lot of things had to work in our favor, because for 3.5 months we were told how we had no chance. Some of our friends who said they'd be there with us left us because they thought we were dead in the water. Everybody pretty well wrote us off, and we just kept pushing the boulder up the hill. You know, every day we'd work a little bit, chip away at it, knock doors, go to parades, go to events, meet people, gather endorsements. We had a really neat, innovative plan on media, especially using Facebook to target actual voters, not just throwing stuff at the wall and hoping it would stick. Just had a really good plan. And I would say also that I just really believe my faith played a part in it, and it's where the Lord had us. And I think that was really important as well.
In some respects, you started off at a disadvantage after redistricting. It became a much more St. Louis-centric district with St. Charles, Lincoln, Pike, Montgomery mixed with Callaway. Did that give you some pause?
It was certainly a much more difficult district once St. Charles area was added in, because Jeannie's district, Senator Riddle, our current senator, who's a friend and mentor, and she helped us a ton by endorsing our campaign, which helped us, I think, in Lincoln County in particular. But that new district was very, very different. And I think when five people got in the race from all over the district, I think the reason why we really thought we had a chance and believed that from the time we started to the end was that because we were the only candidate from Callaway County, and knowing what I knew about our support in the district in Callaway County and how the connections I'd made over 8 years were just really strong. And we felt like money couldn't buy that support, the goodwill that was created over years. We just really felt like we always had a path because Callaway County, we just knew Callaway County was going to come through. And towards the end, when we observed that most of the candidates didn't spend any time in Callaway County at all, I'm not even sure Mike even stepped foot in Callaway County. I could be wrong, but I don't know that he was ever there. And the other candidates didn't spend any time. There weren't any signs there for any of them, really, maybe a smattering. There was one that I knew of Mike Carter, and maybe one or two for Spencer. Jeff Porter had some kind of a northeast area that were connected to Montgomery County, but really no effort was made to even build anything from a Senate campaign in Callaway County. We just really felt like if that were the case, it gave us a significant advantage. And that certainly played out when you looked at the end result. But we didn't just work in Callaway County. Like, we worked really hard in Lincoln County. Once Randy Peitzman got out, I can't remember when, but about a month and a half ago or whenever it was.
And Randy Peitzman, he was terming out of the Missouri House. He filed to run for the seat, but then withdrew, I think, one of the last days possible to withdraw, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I thought he missed the deadline for that. Actually, I didn't even know that you could go to the court and get some court order to pull your name off the ballot. But that's what he did on the very last day that was possible. And he was very well liked in Lincoln County, very popular. We were obviously very concerned about his candidacy, but we still felt like even with him in, we still felt like we had a path because we knew Callaway County was going to come through for us. Mm-hmm. And so we just, we worked really hard in Lincoln County, especially once Randy got out, but we knew we were going to anyway, even with Randy who stayed in. We worked hard in Wentzville. The one dynamic that I think helped us tremendously was the getting the endorsement of the Fraternal Order of Police and the firefighters mm-hmm. in the state of Missouri. That mattered a ton. And when we walked around and knocked doors, we heard that so often that people were just really taking care of cops, supporting them, and fighting for our community safety was a huge, huge issue when we talked to voters. And so that went a really long way. And so that helped us in Wentzville. It helped us in Lincoln County, helped us in Pike, just across the district. Cops and firefighters appreciated our support, and we appreciated theirs. It was so meaningful to us.
So one of the things that I was paying attention to in this race is just the candidacy of Mike Carter in general. Mike Carter, for listeners who don't know who he is, has been running in various elections around Missouri since at least 2008. Typically, his mode of campaigning has just been spending money on robocalls. But in this campaign, he loaned himself $500,000 and put together what, for all intents and purposes, was a real campaign with billboards and broadcast ads. And there was polling that came out shortly before this race was called, showing him in the lead by a pretty healthy margin. But unlike the U.S. Senate race, which we're going to talk about later in the show, those polls turned out to be pretty wrong. Is it just really difficult to accurately do public polls of state Senate races? Or was it a situation where maybe he was in the lead at that point, but you were just on an upward trajectory to where it peaked at the right time?
I think it's a combination of those things. I think the easy answer is yes, it's impossible to poll legislative districts, especially when we heard a lot of people just kind of tired of phone calls. So I think the polling just was off because I think maybe you were polling the same people over and over. Who knows where they were, what they were voting on any given day. We saw some numbers for the other candidate from Mexico, Missouri, who didn't even live in the district, but he was getting high numbers across areas where we were that doesn't make any sense. And so, we just figured that people weren't taking the polling very seriously. And what we heard on the doors was we didn't go to doors and felt like Mike had really strong support. We didn't hear a lot of people saying, "I'm all in on Mike Carter." Usually I've knocked, I don't know how many thousands of doors over my political career, but usually when you have somebody who has strong support, you hear it on the doors. And I can count on my hand the amount of people that said, "I'm for Mike Carter," on one hand, while we were knocking doors, which made us feel like we had a chance, we had a path. And his support seemed very soft, and he spent a lot of money, obviously, and he did a good job, like, branding himself as a Trump Republican, and you know, I think he did a lot of things well, but we really finished very strong. And I do think we were behind in the polls because there were some trends that you can kind of, you can't rely on a poll, but you can at least find some trends. But we saw in the little that we knew about polling, because our campaign didn't do any polling, we just heard from through the grapevine that we were down, and everybody kept telling us nonstop that we had no chance. So we just kept going and kept saying, "Listen, we believe we have a path, because we're not hearing what is being told to us by people that should know that we're behind." And we just kept going.
Moving on to the state of the Missouri Senate, a lot of people were watching state Senate primaries to see how many members the conservative caucus would add. Would it be fair to say that you'll likely not join that caucus?
Yeah, I won't join the conservative caucus. I think, though, it's way too early to say that because their numbers grew that the state Senate can't function. And that was part of my big message, was I have great relationships with conservative caucus members in the Senate and Republicans and Democrats. Like, I've always just made my career about building strong relationships. I just got off the phone with Nick Schroer a couple minutes ago before our call to congratulate him. I had a great conversation. I think the Senate needs to be about relationships, and I think that's how you move the needle. And that's my goal, is to build relationships with each individual senator, so that we can do what we told our voters we would do, is go in there and make the changes that they're asking for.
In addition to Representative Schroer, if he wins the second district race, he will likely join the conservative caucus. You also had Mary Elizabeth Coleman. If she wins her race, will probably join Ben Brown in the 26th district. And then Jill Carter beating Bill White in the Joplin area. And also, it should be noted that Rick Bratton and Mike Moon did not win their congressional races, so they will be back in the Senate. You kind of alluded to this, but they have a decent amount of numbers now, and if they stand unified, they can really slow things down. Like, how do you think this will impact how the Senate operates after 2023?
I think if, Jason, you know this as well as anybody, I don't think you can ever predict how the Missouri Senate's going to function in any given year. But I think the proof will be in the pudding. I think there's several things that they want to get accomplished that I would agree with, that I think we ought to be working on in this next legislative session. I think there are plenty of things we share thoughts on that the relationships just matter. And so we've got to push to get some things done. And so I think it's way too early to say that 2023 is just going to be a lost cause. I think everybody kind of assumes that, but I'm not assuming that, because I just have so much to learn. You know, the Senate was a mess last year. I think everybody saw that, and that was the message I said when I was out on the stump. But I think there's plenty of blame to go around, and I think we just need leaders that are going to go in and work with people and to get things done that Missourians are asking for. And I'm not writing off 2023, because I just have a lot to learn. I have a lot of relationships to build. I've talked to Mary Elizabeth Coleman. We have a good relationship. I talked to Curtis Trent. He's a great guy, and I think he'll do well as a senator. I talked to Ben Brown, really impressed with him. He's a good friend of Paul Kirtman, Paul's one of my great friends. And I just think that the relationships move the needle, and I think that's what's going to be important in 2023. And we'll see how it goes. There's obviously rifts that need to be dealt with. There's leadership races that are going to be very, very interesting because of the dynamics of this primary election. But I think there's a lot of space to show Missourians that we can govern.
Do you think that, you know, possible pickups within the conservative caucus, do you think that could increase the relevance of Senate Democrats, since their votes will be needed to pass things if the conservative caucus holds strong? Or do you think that the conservative caucus could use their leverage to push the Senate to pass more controversial legislation?
I think that remains to be seen, too. I think, you know, the Democrats are announcing that they feel more relevant than they ever have been, because they think that's a path. And I just think that the conservative caucus probably needs to be given a lot more consideration about the issues that they have in front of them. And we bring up some of those issues and take votes. Now, I'm not in leadership. I'm saying things that I don't, you know, I have a lot to learn, but I think that, that we got to sit down and figure out what the policy agenda is for the next session and have a plan going into it so that the, so that Republican legislation, good Republican legislation and our conservative values, which is what we run our campaigns on, will be prioritized going into the legislative session in 2023. So I think it's just way too early just to, again, to write it off and say that, you know, that, that we're not going to be successful, because I think there's space to be successful and get things done. It just takes getting in a room and not yelling at each other on the House, on the Senate floor.
Yeah. Speaking of policy, what are some policies that you would want to focus on when you get to the Senate?
That's a great question. I think protecting kids is a big deal. I think there's a lot of space for, figuring out how do we deal with the mental health issues. My wife is a licensed professional counselor. She works with kids, and the mental health needs in our communities today are just significant. We have these foster care parents and adoptive parents that have kids that have incredible amounts of needs. I would love to figure out ways to make the adoption process and foster care easier for parents and giving more resources to those folks. And I think that's really, really important in our state going forward, is taking care of kids. There's also, there are kids that have been abused across the state. Lincoln County in particular has what I've been told is about 1,000 cases of child abuse that need to be investigated and adjudicated in our court system.
And I think that was like that was a big conflict during the last veto session, wasn't it, Sarah?
Last year, I believe it was, because we tried to get some money in the budget investigation for the sheriff's office in Lincoln County to have some money for investigating these crimes.
Yeah, the House overturned it, but then the Senate didn't. So
yeah, and that was a priority for Randy Peitzman. I got that money. I helped Randy get that money back in the budget this year, but it's more of a statewide level now. So there's kind of a grant program from the state. For every county to apply for, but Lincoln County in particular, I hope that they can get some funds and they can hire some investigators to start adjudicating these issues. We just have to protect kids. So that's one big thing that's important to us, not only as a legislator, but personally as a family. We just see it on a regular basis. My wife is dealing with some kids that just need services. They need help. And I think that's really important. Secondly, I just think, you know, the federal government is really concerning. Like, as a very progressive Democrat president, at least in my opinion, you know, they're doing some things that we've got to push back on, in my opinion, especially energy wise. The state of our energy policy is very concerning. And I'm just a nuclear energy advocate, and there's not a whole lot we can do on a state level to encourage that other than to be a voice to Congress and say, we got to stop being scared of nuclear energy, because it's the only way to replace baseload power if you get rid of coal plants like we are without hurting the, you know, having carbon-free energy. And so, you know, we have to be leaders in the energy space as well. For Missourians, because their rates are going to keep going up as coal plants are being retired. So we have to have an energy policy that makes sense. And that's kind of pushing back against the federal government's overregulating the things that we ought to be embracing, like nuclear energy. I think there's economic policy that has to be discussed. I think Missourians should get a lot more money back from the state, because last year we were up 20% in general revenue year over year, which means we're overtaxing. And I just saw the new revenue numbers this morning for July, and they were up, I think, 38-39% just in the last month from last year, which is just, you know, the government is getting a lot of money, and we ought to be giving some of that back to Missourians. So that will be another discussion, is how do we do tax policy that is fair to Missourians and gives them more of their money back, because they spend it a lot better, in my opinion, than the government does.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative and future state senator Travis Fitzwater.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association. Missouri produces wood pallets, railroad ties, white oak barrels, hardwood floors, and more. Details on the variety of products made in the state are at choosewood.com.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Travis Fitzwater. He is a Republican from Callaway County who just won the 10th District Republican Senate primary. So you were a good segueer, because our next topic of discussion is the likely special session over a tax cut and also agriculture tax credits. You actually met with the governor about this. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, I think the governor was just trying to promote what he would like to see out of a special session. It was an interesting conversation. What they want to do on the tax side is basically lower our income tax to 4.8 right now. The only problem with that is that we've already done that. It's just triggered by revenue increases over the next several years. I was the co-author with Senator Bill Eigel on that tax cut bill a couple years ago that eventually became Elijah Haar's tax cut bill that got passed, which would reduce our income tax down to I think 5.1 or 5.2, something like that. And then last year when we passed the Wayfair, I believe it reduced it down again to 4.8. But so he just wants to accelerate. The governor wants to accelerate that down to 4.8 now, since we have so much money in our coffers and our general revenues are through the roof. For me as a Republican, I think that they're through the roof and that we can go. And I think it's in large part because of the tax cuts we passed years ago. I think it's doing exactly what we hoped it would do, which is build our economy and increase our revenues by encouraging investment. And so I just would like to be more aggressive on it. And I think the Speaker of the House, Rob Wiscova, and I talked about this the other day. I think he agrees. And so we'll see how that plays out. But I think the biggest goal for the governor is for everybody to be on the same page before he announces a special session. And I wonder if we can actually get to an agreement before a special session. And I think that will be the biggest determinant of whether we have one or not, is whether all the parties involved can sit down and come to some conclusion on what that should look like without turning the special session into kind of a shooting match.
Obviously, the state has a huge surplus right now, and even Democratic lawmakers have said there should be some form of tax relief. But given that many Americans have already received stimulus checks or child tax credits, would a tax cut from the state really make much of a difference compared to, you know, maybe eliminating the tax on food or other sales taxes?
I think the reducing the income tax, which I think is just very harsh against investment, especially for entrepreneurs. And this has kind of been the space that I've been in as a policymaker for several years, is really being interested in entrepreneurs and how to get them off the ground. Like, we need to give Missourians as much space as possible to start businesses, to keep as much money as they can in their pockets. And I think that the reducing the income tax is maybe the most effective way to do that, to encourage investment in the state of Missouri. And I also think on the low end, like, we've also got to figure out ways to make sure that low income folks are also keeping more of their money if they're paying taxes or I've always been an advocate of earned income tax credit. Yes. I've always been an advocate of that. You know, I think those things are important too. So we got to figure out ways to empower people to start companies and keep more of their money so that they can keep growing our economy in a significant way.
Does the fact that the state is going to get billions of dollars from the federal infrastructure bill mean that there's just not really enough things to spend the surplus on?
That's why I think, again, you hope that we would give more money back to Missourians, because we're overtaxing at that point. Secondly, you know, that brings up a good point. Like, we need to have a long-term solution on infrastructure. Like, you know, we're doing a lot of fixes here and there, but I think the governor is very interested in a long-term plan. I know Lieutenant Governor Kehoe is. I think a lot of policymakers ought to be more interested at this point, since we are going to expect these billions of dollars, to have a long-term 10-year, 15-year, 20-year plan on state infrastructure, because 70 needs to be expanded. You know, there are other highways in the state. 44 gets more, I think, more industrial traffic than any other highway in the state. We've got a lot of work to do on infrastructure to continue to encourage this investment in the state. So there's just a lot. And what the federal government does on the infrastructure will be interesting too, because they're just in the middle of an election year, and inflation is still through the roof. And there are a lot of concerns about federal spending.
Obviously, this revenue trajectory that you mentioned is not going to last forever. So how do you make sure whatever tax cut gets passed doesn't make it more difficult in the future to fund basic state governmental services?
I think you just have to have some saved. You know, I remember in 2008, and that recession lingered in our budget for a long time. I can't remember when it really finally started to feel like we were going on the upswing, maybe 2016, maybe 2015. I don't remember exactly. It was when I was first in the legislature. It felt like we were still struggling.
It was a while. Like, obviously, 2009 was like helped a little bit because there was the Obama stimulus money that came to the state. But after that went away, like it did feel like the state was kind of treading water for a few years, especially because they laid off a bunch of state workers. And my understanding is they didn't really replace those workers for a really long time. And you could correct me if I'm wrong there.
No, I think they're statewide, or not statewide, but throughout state government, we're down significantly. Because I think if you talk to any business, you know that we have a people shortage on jobs. That is certainly the case across departments in our state. It's a good and bad problem that there are jobs available, but the bad is obviously not having the people to fill them. So we have a lot of workforce development issues, a lot of economic development issues we've got to figure out going forward. But I think as far as the tax cuts go, I think we have so much money in our coffers at this point that we have more than enough to give back to Missourians and enough to put on our bottom line to be prepared for the recession that we're in and may be in for the short to long term. So I think in a recessionary time when we have tons of money in our coffers, we ought to be giving it back to Missourians. Like I mentioned, they spend it, in my opinion, a lot better than the government does. But we also have to be prepared for that recessionary issue. And I think we have enough money to do so.
The income tax cut is kind of one part of what Governor Parson wants. And the other is on these agricultural tax credits. What exactly needs to be done there? And that's an important question for you since your Senate district has a lot of agriculture in it.
Sure. The ag community, for investment in one of our most important industries in the state of Missouri, it's crucial to have those things available. And so I think that getting something done in that space, you know, I would prefer the governor just didn't veto that bill, but you know, it is what it is. Here we are. So I think we'll do, in my opinion, we do whatever it takes to ensure that those tax credits are renewed, whether it's overriding a veto, which I don't think is on the table. I don't think that's a possibility in the Senate. I don't know that it's a possibility in the House. Or coming to the table and figuring out how to do 6-year sunsets. I don't know because I've just been trying to fight through the primary before I even started worrying about the special session. I think that there is space to get something done in a special session, but I think the governor obviously wants the 6-year, and I would prefer a 6-year sunset as well. It gives more stability to those programs anyway. But I haven't been in the back rooms figuring out what that negotiation looks like quite yet. So I'm not sure how that's going to go. I think that's a little bit more, to me, I'm not sure.
Yeah, you know, with those sunsets, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember it originally had that 6-year sunset, right? And then it was reduced?
Yeah, that was just a negotiation. There was some politics being played with that particular thing because the folks in the Senate knew that would be a significant battle and worth bringing back to the table in a couple of years to renegotiate. So yeah, I don't know all the dynamics because I wasn't in the Senate and I didn't negotiate that bill. I just knew that there were some significant conversations about that piece. So I just wonder if that will be a hang up because vetoing a priority for a number of conservative caucus members in the Senate, which was the 2-year sunset, and then expecting them to just say, okay, we're fine with the 6-year sunset now is going to be an interesting conversation. And again, I'm not a part of those conversations, but I think that's a dynamic that's worth like figuring out.
So in the last topic, let's shift into the 2022 elections, which as I mentioned, unless there's a libertarian extravaganza in Callaway Pike, St. Charles, Lincoln, and Montgomery counties. And I hear that.
Can I just say this really quick?
Yeah.
Like, I think the last guy that was guaranteed to win didn't win. So, you know, we'll run a hefty campaign to make sure that we win in November.
Yeah, and I hear that the libertarians are really popular in Avos. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you said Avos. It's a not really important community.
Not Oxfast. I believe that is one of the first times we communicate with each other. With Eric Schmidt winning the GOP Senate primary, what do you expect in the general election for that contest?
I expect Eric Schmidt to win. He's a tremendous candidate. I think he was the best candidate. I'm glad that he pulled it out. And I don't know that it becomes, you know, the Democrat primary was really close. I was, you know, it's like surprisingly close. And I think that's in part because Lucas worked incredibly hard on the ground, it seemed. And Miss Valentine, Bush Valentine, I think she, you know, she spent a lot of money and did a good job on her marketing. But still, I think this is just a Republican state. And I think Schmidt's about as good a candidate as you're going to get on the Republican side. And I think that's going to probably pull some people out too in that general election, because they know the importance of a U.S. Senate seat going to Republicans in the state. And so I think the turnout is going to be pretty significant in an off election year.
Do you think that John Wood, who is the former U.S. attorney who's running as an independent, could complicate things for Republicans, especially if Trudy Bush Valentine gets her bearings and starts catching fire?
No, I don't think so.
Why?
If I were guessing, I just, from what I'm hearing in my district on the ground, you know, people are just mad about the John Wood thing. And I think they kind of see through it that it could be a spoiler. And I just don't see him getting traction. Now I could be very wrong. And I've been very wrong in the past, but I don't see him catching fire now. Now, if we had an Eric Greitens as our U.S. Senate candidate, maybe a different story, but I just don't see him overtaking an Eric Schmidt in this and doing enough damage to hurt Eric, who may win by double digits, even with John in the race.
You know, not in Missouri, but in Kansas, we saw kind of the vote that basically affirmed abortion rights. There's been some conjecture that that Missouri's trigger law that banned most abortions could spark a backlash, even among voters who feel abortion is morally wrong. What do you think about that?
I don't know. I think it's yet to be seen. I talked to one consultant yesterday who thought that it could probably raise turnout for Democrats a little bit in the fall, but I don't know that it's going to be enough to change many of these races. I think a lot of the, especially state Senate races, are, you know, they're not a lot of competitive ones. So I think where it probably has the biggest impact is probably the U.S. Senate race. And I think it could motivate suburban voters, but I don't know that it has enough of an impact to really change any outcome in that race in particular.
My last question for you was that I noticed that there were several Democratic and Republican lawmakers, especially in the House, but one example in the Senate, who lost re-election in primaries on Tuesday. Should we read into any of that, or were some of these situations just redistricting quirky situations that may not have actually had anything to do with broader trends?
You know, Jason, that's a great question. I think the answer is probably just like my race. There were just so many dynamics. It's hard to put your finger on any one of them, but I think redistricting certainly had a big impact. I think there were some folks that worked behind the scenes that were effective in many districts, but maybe not as effective in other districts. I think there, you know, people, Republicans, conservative Republicans, especially in rural areas, and we heard this a lot too, is they just want leaders that are going to get things done, not like bicker and their egos overwhelm them and don't disallow the legislature from getting things done. And I think that has an anti-incumbency feel sometimes. And so I think you saw a little bit of that, but redistricting, I would say, certainly had a large impact. Some new areas, some dynamic changes in districts. I mean, mine alone, like, it just significantly changed the dynamics of our race. You know, if you don't add Wentzville, if you don't have Wentzville in that district, you know, it's a whole different race for the primary. So yes, I think redistricting was a big piece, but there were a lot of little things also that played into how the elections went on Tuesday.
Well, Representative, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to having you back in the subsequent years to talk about policy as well as politics. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. How can people follow you on Twitter, Sarah?
That's Sarah K. Kellogg, two L's, two G's.
And I know that you are a very online guy, Representative. So how can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
Yeah, if you just Google Travis Fitzwater, you'll find me. It's at Travis Fitzwater on most all social media platforms.
Thank you very much. And until next time, so long.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.